This is session 22, a panel discussion on the proclamation of the family, the way we ought to be, or the way we never were. I'm Rebecca Chandler. I just came in last night from Ohio, and I'll be chairing this session. We have two panelists, and we hope a lot of good discussion. There are 50 copies of the Proclamation on the Family circulating, so if you don't have one in hand so that you can take a good look at what we're discussing, get hold of one. Our first panelist today will be Doral Jensen. Mr. Jensen lives in Greensboro, North Carolina. He's a professor of German language and literature at the University of North Carolina. He's a father and a grandfather. He has a little bit more biographical information that he'll include in his presentation. After his presentation, we'll hear from Brad Hess, who lives here in the area at University Park, Maryland. He has a degree in international management, and he works for the federal government. He writes grant proposals for business development for the Department of Commerce. He's a former host of a public radio program called Man of the House and managed the parent organization that sponsored that program for some time. He's also married and the father of three boys. So we'll hear from those two panelists in that order. Are we okay? We're okay. All right, thank you.
I teach an honors seminar titled Art and the Erotic. The title alone seems enough to always ensure a healthy enrollment. It deals with culture and ideas in Vienna, Austria, not Virginia, at the turn of the 20th century. I always feel a need to issue a kind of disclaimer on the first day of class. I explain that although this is not a how to enjoy pornography course, we will read plays and stories with unabashedly erotic themes and language. We will examine paintings, drawings, and photographs with explicit treatment of sexual subject matter. And we may discuss in rather graphic terms prostitution, infidelity, pornography, theories of psychosexual development, homosexuality, and even morality. If any student suspects he or she might be offended, this is definitely the wrong course. My experience has been that this speech assures that everyone stays. For slightly different reasons, I feel that I should begin this presentation with something of a disclaimer. I don't want anyone to accuse me of hiding my biases. I submitted biographical information to Sunstone without realizing that they would have room for only two lines on the program. It began something like this. Doral Jensen has four daughters, three granddaughters, with a fourth due this summer, by the way, as well as two sons-in-law and a third scheduled to join the family in June. So he definitely believes in the importance of family and of women. He has served in many church callings, but perhaps his favorite was a long stint as ward primary chorister. The rest of the paragraph was, in retrospect, unimportant. But my family is important to my attitudes and ultimately to my reading of the proclamation. For example, having daughters made me aware of feminist issues in a new way. When the little boys in my oldest daughter's kindergarten were given stethoscopes and the little girls were given nurses' hats, I recognized a wrong which had gone unnoticed at the First Presbyterian Nursery School for years, right up until the moment I marched into the principal's office. I could also try to explain to you why I have maintained my political registration as a Republican for 25 years in Jesse Helms, North Carolina, while my personal approaches to social issues have become increasingly progressive, and while I have not actually voted for a Republican for years. But that would be a difficult explanation. However, there is another important factor coloring the way I see the world. I am not only a lifelong Mormon from pioneer stock, a registered, though repentant, Republican, and the patriarch, so to speak, of a rapidly growing tribe of women, but I am also gay. I do not say that lightly, nor from any tortured need to out myself, but because it matters. It colors the way I see things that I might otherwise not recognize, just as I would see social issues differently if I were African American, like some of my best friends. or Asian American, like one of my sons-in-law, or female, or Jewish, or Muslim, and so on. So let me begin on that point, which may seem to some of you like an odd starting place. I have discussed the proclamation with many friends and acquaintances. A very large number of my straight Mormon friends view it as an affirmative statement of obvious truths, which tells us how to structure an ideal family. It tells us to pray, to be faithful to our spouses, to love and care for our children, to be obedient, etc. However, I believe that every single gay Mormon with whom I have ever broached the subject has expressed, sometimes in anger, sometimes in sadness or frustration, some version of the following statements. It was written to justify the church's treatment of homosexuals and as a cover for the church's political activism and the outlay of millions of dollars to craft anti-gay legislation in Hawaii, Alaska, California, and elsewhere. Its main goal is to deny the very existence of gay men and women. It is not really pro-family because it sets out to deny the validity of any family model except one, etc. So which view, if either, makes sense? Let me begin with some very simple textual analysis. Of the 9 paragraphs in the Declaration, at least 6, and possibly 7 or 8, contain language which can easily be interpreted as directly addressing the issue of homosexuality. As a first example, one litany is particularly noticeable. The assertion that marriage is valid, only valid, between a man and a woman is repeated at least 3 times directly in the text and is implied or circumscribed with phrases like husbands and wives or mothers and fathers or male and female in many other places, according to my quick count, 8 times. In contrast, there are only 2 uses in the entire document of the neutral and inclusive word parents. In addition, the assertion that marriage is between a man and a woman defines that word for every subsequent use throughout the text. The definition resides then in the word. Family is similarly defined by its context in that first paragraph as referring only to that one man and one woman model, of course with the addition of their potential children, which are mentioned later. With these definitions established, the concept is repeated, consciously or subconsciously, every time the word is repeated. 5 times for the words marriage, marital, matrimony, 13 times, I believe, for family, families. The only place where that definition is broadened is the suggestion that extended families should sometimes lend support. To most people, these definitions of family and marriage would be perfectly natural assumptions. So the only reason for this textual overkill is to deal with the gay issue. Once we consciously become aware of this vast subtext, it can be seen hovering behind nearly every statement in the proclamation. It is surely not coincidental that the proclamation was issued in 1995 as the debate was heating up in Hawaii over extending legal recognition to gay couples and when the church was beginning to commit its resources, including millions of dollars, to craft legislation designed to prevent states from granting any rights to gays which might be equivalent to the rights of married individuals. The proclamation's attempt to promote the nuclear family with the father as the breadwinner and the mother at home with the children fails to acknowledge or even recognize the cultural biases inherent in its claims. It certainly denies the validity of the very happy family of my colleague whose husband cares for their home and daughter while she works at the university. Perhaps my friends are really very miserable and just not letting on. The proclamation's gender roles are declared to be the products of divine design, and the family model is not only erroneously declared to be universal, but also eternal. It is ironic, of course, that most of the 19th century Mormon family ideals, and even the celestial organization of God's family, as it has been traditionally taught in Mormonism, lie outside this model. Let's look at the implications of some other statements. Paragraph 2 is one of the most tantalizing and troubling in the proclamation. It is clear, even to my straight friends and local church leaders, that this is an attempt to deal once and for all with the pesky gay issue. It states unequivocally about gender There is really no question about whether a man is really a man or whether a woman is really a woman, because that is part of your eternal identity. As my good friend and former bishop once said to me, "You can't really be gay. You've read the Proclamation on the Family, haven't you?" There are many problems with this concept, but one of the most basic is that homosexuality is seldom about gender confusion. Most gay men I know are not confused about their gender at all. They are simply attracted to their own sex in the way that straight men and women are attracted to one another. No confusion there. Let me tell you a story I have related often. A man of my acquaintance told me that after many years of worrying about his mother's reaction, he finally screwed up his courage to tell her the secret he had kept from her. "Mother," he said, "I am gay." She was determined to react with supportive, open-minded concern. "Oh, son, I'm so sorry. This must have been difficult for you. How long have you wanted to be a woman?" When I tell that story to straight people, they usually nod in empathy with the mother and son. And when I tell it to gay men, they almost invariably burst out in riotous laughter, as I did. They recognize immediately the enormous silliness of the assumption. So back to paragraph 2. This passage attempts to show that a man is always a man, always has been, and always will be. And therefore, he cannot really be homosexual because his divine nature and destiny to procreate would be rendered meaningless. It is his behavior that needs to be changed, and he can become just like the rest of us. This is, in fact, one of the oldest arguments in the church against homosexuals. Attraction to members of one's own gender cannot be part of a person's nature because it is not procreative, which is God's plan and is the reason for and purpose of the sexual attraction which is inherent in gender. In an attempt to emphasize this belief, the proclamation does something amazing. It creates new doctrine out of whole cloth. Mormon theology has taught since the time of Joseph Smith that we are somehow born as children of God and his wife or wives, though I don't hear the plural used much anymore, and that our intelligences apparently antedated that birth back into eternity. But we have only claimed the barest understanding of the nature of premortal spirits and none at all about the nature of intelligences. Now, out of the blue ether, we suddenly learn that gender is an essential and eternal part of our premortal existence. Something we barely understand, apparently now, has gender. So what then is the purpose of gender? Paragraph 4 proclaims that the sacred powers of procreation, the first of two euphemisms in the Proclamation for Sexual Relations, are for the purpose of multiplying and replenishing the earth. Sexual drives are purposeful, given to humans by God to assure procreation. The attraction of a young man to a young woman, the sexual object in Freud's terms, is an ultimately procreative function. So in light of this new doctrine, I have some questions. What is the purpose of eternal, premortal gender? Apparently not for procreation. So then for what? To be blunt, what was the purpose of having genitals without the need or opportunity to procreate? And were boy spirits attracted to the well-built spirit bodies of the girl spirits? And why? And did it leave them really, really frustrated? Pardon my irreverence, but these are real questions. I agree that coming to terms with the actual existence of homosexuals, to say nothing of transgendered individuals, creates problems for Mormon theology. As the proclamation says in paragraph 7, marriage between a man and woman is essential to his eternal plan. The feeling must exist among some brethren that an acknowledgement of any other option will subvert the intentions of God. But in a way, it seems to me much like the problem that the Roman Church had with Galileo. The church authorities saw the sun rotate across the sky and combined that with a long-held view of the universe based on accepted ancient wisdom. It made the truth seem so obvious that the facts could not be allowed to get in the way. A few of the uncomfortable facts are that gay people do not choose to be gay any more than the rest of you choose to be straight. That the church's extensive reparative therapy programs do not have any demonstrable statistical success in changing sexual orientation. According to BYU biology professor William S. Bradshaw, gays are clearly defined by biology and not by behavioral choices, and he says that 500,000 is a conservative estimate of the number of gay Mormons. Many gay brothers and sisters are among the most faithful Mutual Kids missionaries and ward and stake leaders, not to mention parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, friends. Trying to define them out of existence will not change the reality any more than forcing Galileo to recant changed the course of the earth around the sun. The final paragraph is a call to action. Whatever else it may be, it is obvious justification for the church's activism around the country, its large-scale funding of and sometimes clandestine promotion of legislation directed against all potential legal protections for gay families. The greatest irony in the proclamation is that there are many very real threats to the family that are not discussed at all or are given only a cursory mention. Poverty, for example, or lack of education, physical and emotional abuse, poor training and parenting skills, inadequate medical care, or even an increasing trend not to marry at all. BYU sociology professor Tim Heaton lists 8 forces that imperil the family ahead of same-sex couples and finds the danger from that source negligible. The existence of homosexuals and even extending legal protections to gay partners does nothing substantial to harm families. No family is weakened when a gay couple down the block is given legal rights. In what way does this document on the walls of so many Mormon homes strengthen families? Certainly, it offers some nice advice. Love one another, pray, be faithful and responsible. But why does that require a proclamation? The more basic purpose is an attempt to shoot down what are perceived to be errant concepts about gender and roles. And unfortunately, much of that attempt totally misses the point. The ecclesiastical shotguns are aimed at phantoms. Thank you.
Well, I was hoping that Dora would dissect the proclamation. We had met, 10 days or 2 weeks ago to try to determine how we were going to do this, and we never did get quite through our session because our sink overflowed and we had like an inch of water in the kitchen, so there was this immediate crisis and we weren't able to finish, but I would very much enjoy Doral's presentation, and also to hear Doral come out of the closet finally as a Republican. I guess there's a lot that we actually share. Maybe this is time for me to come out too and say that it's been less than a year since I registered as an independent. But I was a Republican too, but I guess I'm further along the path than Doral is. Also wanted to recognize that it's a lot easier for, all I have to do is say, I'm currently a scoutmaster, and people already, I mean, you don't have to say anything more, and Doral has to go into a lot more explanation, and that puts him at a little more of a disadvantage than me. Though, don't read too much into what I just said. I'm a scoutmaster. Don't assume too much. Anyway, well, you can assume I spend a lot of time with boys, and they must have a lot of patience, that you can assume. I want to start by acknowledging, before I get in legal trouble about part of our title, The Way We Never Were. This comes from a 1992 book by historian Stephanie Kuntz, wherein she contends that, among other things, historically there's never been much traditional or nuclear about American family life. It was only 3 years later that the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, the Brethren, of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Church, issued the proclamation on the family. Marriage, they declared, between a man and woman is essential to God's eternal plan, and children are entitled to birth within the bonds of matrimony. Now, according to the Brethren, then, the nuclear family is the way we ought to be. In my mind, the two ideas are not mutually exclusive. It can be both the way many of us never were and the way we ought to be. Still, I acknowledge that within the church, many are uncomfortable with this idea. And I think some of the discomfort stems from a misunderstanding of what the proclamation really is. It's not an encyclopedia of every role model that benefits society. It's also not a bill of rights. It's just an ideal. The rights are mentioned, in the proclamation, not in reference to adults, but to children who deserve a life with both a mom and a dad married to one another. Now, the proclamation is serious stuff. It makes us uncomfortable. But the Brethren are not reading us our rights. They are recruiting us to raise the next generation. Perhaps the most effective way to raise the next generation is by role modeling. In fact, if you think about it, role modeling is a defining characteristic not just of parenting, but of the Mormon faith. One thing that distinguishes us from other monotheists is that technically we're not monotheists. For us, God the Father is not mysteriously bound up with Christ and with the Holy Ghost. They're separate, three separate beings. Moreover, God is not an amorphous concept, of course, without form. God is our size, our shape, our form. As the Brethren remind us, all human beings, male and female, are created in the image of God. Therefore, God is not androgynous either. He is our Father in heaven. He's not our parent in heaven. And he is not alone. We Mormons are unique in looking upon God not just as deity, but as role model. When Christ said, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect," we took him literally. If gender is an essential characteristic, then, of individual, premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose, as the Brethren have declared, then, given our divine nature and destiny, we progress by following male and female role models in heaven. If our eternal destiny, then, is to become like our heavenly parents, is it any surprise that the ideal lifestyle, immortality, is based on marriage and parenthood? Traditionally, the biggest challenge is to recruit the male role model to family building. How can society recruit husbands and fathers? Well, one way not to do it is by telling men that it does not matter how they channel their sexual energy. Now, recognize that the vast majority of men will want to have sex with women, and the vast majority of women will want to have babies. Now, society can direct these two complementary forces to come together only within the bounds of matrimony, or it can do nothing and suffer the consequences. This means, of course, that men should not seek sex outside marriage, and this pact will work only with the cooperation of women as well. Women who allow sex without marital commitment undercut the institution of marriage that children, indeed society, need so desperately. If men can get sex without marriage, women will get children without husbands. and children will grow up seeing men as irrelevant in family life. This looming irrelevance of men is a characteristic of several lifestyles. Shacking up, as Fleetwood Mac refers to cohabitation without marriage, literally reassures a man, you can go your own way. Single motherhood by design, a la Murphy Brown, very obviously writes men out of the picture, out of the script. So does lesbian partnership. And I'm not, again, I'm not going to try to be encyclopedic either. I'm just listing some examples. I've never known a lesbian couple who did not appear to be top-notch parents. But what message do they send to their children about the role of men in families? Increasingly, men are being thought of as options for families instead of standard equipment. By contrast, the plan, indeed the example of our Father in Heaven, indicates an integral male role model in the eternal family. And lacking much of the natural compulsion to nurture that women have, men depend more on society to tell them what to do. They need a defined role. Perhaps this is why the brethren give more prominence to fathers to preside over their families in love, and a responsibility to provide the necessities of life and protection for their families. This question is a standard one for anthropologists. What do we do with the men? The ideal answer is to conscript them as husbands and fathers, because without a prescribed role, men risk becoming irrelevant to family life. Let me grab my water here. Now, men and women will make babies without regardless of what society says. But many men, perhaps even the majority, will not direct their male energy to family development unless society prescribes it. Just as marriage and parenting needs to be prescribed for husbands and fathers, mothers need to be supported as well. It used to be that a vulnerable wife and mother could expect, if not universal support from society, at least some respect. In the not-too-distant past, influences that competed with her for the attention of her husband were officially unacceptable to society or outlawed, and women who had sex without marriage were ostracized. If in decades past these so-called loose women felt alone, well, that was the price that they paid for trying to buck society's family value. Nowadays, they might end up with their own TV show. By contrast, it's all too often today's stay-with-their-child moms who feel that they are the ones going it alone. Society owes it to the next generation to stop making moms wonder if being primarily with their kids when they need them the most is a good idea. Society can lend its support to these moms in many ways. I'll highlight another one because it so figures in the proclamation. Sex outside marriage should be identified as something that hinders nuclear families, the elemental units of society. Moms focused on helping young children get no benefit from promiscuity. Wandering men get a thrill, and the women they have sex with get a temporary sense of security, but ultimately everybody loses. Society receives no benefit from sex outside marriage. So just as society must ordain men to be fathers, it must support women as mothers. Again, the goal of the brethren is not to affirm the lifestyle we have already chosen, but to identify the lifestyle that is most likely to benefit society. We see this again with regard to sexual expression. I believe that the stance of the brethren is well-grounded in Scripture, but it might ultimately be inspired by Darwin. Animals like ourselves have genitals for self-fulfillment, not for self-fulfillment, but for procreation. Self-fulfillment may be tied in the short term to sexual activity, or in a more lasting way, to the companionship that results from shared experience. And I believe this is true whether you're gay or straight. But ultimately, all of this is of interest to society only if it results in improvement in the next generation. can't the church just wink at a bit of sex among consenting adults or teens as long as it's safe and nobody gets their feelings hurt? Well, if no one is getting their feelings hurt by loving someone and leaving them, then we must wonder if we are attaching any feeling at all to sex. If we are not, then how can it be part of the glue that holds nuclear families together or anyone else? More specifically, societal approval of sexual expression outside of marriage weakens the nuclear family. Remember those men who sacrificed, or those women, sorry, those moms who sacrificed their career, imperiled their body, and otherwise made themselves vulnerable in order to focus attention on the next generation? Does it help them to have to compete for attention with beautiful, young, unattached women who can offer themselves freely to their husbands? Ultimately, freeing sexual expression from the bonds of marriage undercuts worst those who society depend on most to produce its future, mothers. Before I conclude, let me summarize. Marriage and the nuclear family can be both the way many of us never were and the way we ought to be. The proclamation is serious. The brethren are not reading us our rights. They are recruiting us to raise the next generation. If our eternal destiny is to become like our heavenly parents, is it any surprise that the ideal lifestyle and mortality is based on marriage and parenthood? Without a prescribed role, however, men risk becoming irrelevant in family life. And just as society must ordain men to be fathers, it must support women as mothers. Because ultimately, freeing sexual expression from the bonds of marriage undercuts worst those who society depends on most to produce the next generation. Now, I focused a lot on why society needs marriage and the nuclear family. However, the benefits are not all collective. Again, the proclamation, the family is ordained of God. Marriage between a man and woman is essential to his eternal plan. Now, how might marriage be essential to any one of us as well as to all of us collectively as a group? Well, marriage and parenthood does not just populate society with good children. It makes better adults, too. The friction and heat that naturally result from nuclear family life hones us and refines us into better people. There are certainly many ways we can better ourselves. However, marriage and parenthood may very well be the only way that most of us can learn the kind of sacrifice, devotion, and love needed to become more like our heavenly parents. Thanks.
If I had had an opportunity to bring another panelist, I would like to have brought a student at the school where I teach who represents the next generation. She's a young woman, 17 years old, ready to graduate from Laurel School. As a senior, she'll be starting Brown in the fall. And she's the only other Mormon in the school. I'm the only Mormon faculty member, and she's the only Mormon student. I'm really sorry to see her leave. She's lived in the ward since she was just a little girl, and her parents brought her, having both graduated from BYU Law School, and I watched her grow up and had her in class. And she gave her senior speech on her family, and in a lot of ways it had to do with the proclamation on the family. She started out by saying, "I'm a typical Laurel girl. I'm blonde. I have blue eyes. I play field hockey. I do all these things that typical Laurel girls do. Oh, but wait, I'm Mormon, and I'm the only Mormon in this school. So maybe that's not so typical." And I get tired of answering those questions people ask Mormons. Questions like, "How many wives does your husband have? Does your father have?" And so I've come up with flip answers for these things. She says things like, "My mother used to date Donny Osmond," you know, just to shut people up. And when they ask how many wives her father has, she says, "Well, none, but he has a boyfriend." And then she says, "Wait, that's true." And it is. because her parents were divorced when she was about 11, when her father made the decision that marriage had been a mistake for him. And he now lives in New York with his boyfriend. They've been together for 5 years. And the family has completely reconfigured. And Kim, this young lady, has had to deal with that, she and her brother Daniel. Her mother subsequently remarried. And the gentleman she remarried is also divorced. His wife was African-American, so he has biracial children. So she's a typical Laurel girl who happens to be a Mormon, whose father happens to be gay, who happens to have biracial siblings. But she feels really typical. It seems to me that our conversation can take several directions here. We can talk about ideals. We can talk about philosophy. We can talk about how things ought to be or how things were. We can look at the gap between how things ought to be and how they are. We can look at how we verify how things will be if a particular course of action is followed and how we can demonstrate that that really does play out. We can look at how things are and how that plays out for families. And we look forward to your contribution. I wonder if this microphone, it does. Should we do an Oprah Winfrey approach so that you don't feel that you have to come up here and invite you to use this microphone and ask questions of either of our panelists or offer your own perspective on this really broad but terribly important topic? So who wants to start? Someone has to. How about you? Please. It looked as if you wanted to interrupt the introduction.
It's only because I wasn't listening closely enough, and I'm not even sure this is on. Is this on? Okay. Brad suggested that marriage is a situation that brings out the best in the people involved because of everything it teaches the two, sacrifice, cooperation, and all of that, and I am in complete agreement with that. And since I'm also quite sure that Brad would not want someone who was gay but trying to be straight to marry one of his own daughters, and so what shall we do with that gay man? Wouldn't it be best for all of society for that gay man to be motivated to enter into a marriage arrangement also?
That's a really good question. I think that what you have to look at is, I think in this country we need to, in this country, in the world generally, but all we can deal with, I think, here in this room is the United States, I suppose, and
we're doing great if we can deal with that.
Yeah, if we can deal with that. So let's look at it in that context. We have inherited, you know, the concept of what marriage is really a hodgepodge of things that we've inherited from the Romans, from medieval European society, and various other places. A lot of it has to do with property. A lot of it has to do with, you know, old Roman law and all kinds of stuff. I think it is time for society to reevaluate what purpose marriage serves in society. Let me start with that. And I think that primarily marriage serves the purpose to channel primarily heterosexual male energy toward the next generation. Marriage is not for women. It's for men. It's really, the idea is to bind men to women and the children they produce. And that makes all the sense in the world to me. And I'd like to discard all the other stuff and just focus on that. That is how marriage serves society. Marriage is not, I think we need to move away from this romantic image of marriage. Because romance, marriage is not, as far as society is concerned, marriage is not the summit that you reach after the end of this romantic journey to the top of the mountain. That's not what marriage is for society. Marriage for society is keeping men out of trouble because they're going to produce kids anyway. And that's, in my opinion, that start from there, and I think you can redefine marriage in a productive way.
This is a very flattering portrayal of men.
So what would your opinion be of teaching birth control, teaching safe sex in schools? Is that promoting the family? I mean, because it's sounding like you're saying that men need to be harnessed, that sexual energy needs to be harnessed into these marriages. And it seems to me the other alternative would be teaching safe sex to young children.
To prevent democracy.
Right.
Okay.
Well, do you want to address that first, Oral, since I just had one?
Oh, no, go ahead. You're the expert.
Well, hey, thanks a lot. I had my answer all ready to go until I tried to pitch it to Doral. You have to trust me on that one. So do we teach? Well, I think, you know, the morality of sexuality it really ought to be taught by in the home, by the parents, and by the institutions that the parents choose to follow that provide a framework of morality. And that would, you know, a church, a synagogue, or whatever else. It's an issue that we personally haven't confronted in our family because our kids are educated at home. And that's not the reason they're educated at home either. So for sex education, I think it has to be wound up with morality, and I think the parents have to be responsible to do it. And if they want to be assisted by their whatever moral framework they have, that's the way to go. I think we're looking on the schools to do way too much. You know, schools are, because we ask them to do way too much, they're doing too much, and then we hang it over the heads of the teachers. Well, you're failing the next generation. No, if anyone's failing the next generation, it's parents.
I don't really have anything terribly important to add to that, except that I am always suspicious of especially conservative religious groups who are horrified that our children might want to have sex if we let them know that it's fun. And, you know, we do that in the Mormon Church to some extent, but I've lived long enough in the South, I got to be careful what I say here, to know that anything I can complain about Mormons goes triple for Southern Baptists. And I was struck several years ago, I can't tell you which program it was, but there was one of the magazine programs on television did interviews with people and children in Holland and I believe maybe also Denmark, where young people have in schools complete access to information, to condoms, to all kinds of health information. In Holland, there are programs on television for teenagers to call in with their sexual questions and so forth, the kinds of things that simply would horrify everyone I know in Greensboro. The interesting part of that was that the statistics in terms of how many young people waited for marriage to have sex, the numbers of premarital pregnancies, all of those kinds of things were better in Holland than they were in the United States. So I think giving information and helping, it has to do with the framework, the family structure, what people are taught. It's not, I'm worried about people who fear for their families if we let children have information.
We spent some time in Europe a couple of years ago and encountered this same phenomenon. The kids I taught just thought American students were unbelievably naive and puritanical and pointed to our premarital pregnancy rates by saying, you know, this obviously doesn't work. Why don't you just open up and let the kids have the information they need? And maybe you won't have the social problems you have in your country. And that's hard to answer. That is hard. That's hard to answer. Someone else.
I'll address the panelists as well as maybe the group. I have a real concern is that men are bad and women are good. And so men need to be harnessed into these into the formal marriage relationship to assist them. And that just seems very reminds me a lot of the Victorian idea of this female ideal of putting them up on the pedestal or something. And also, to me, it disparages men. And that is a concern to me. And then it's also something that I see in church that is perpetuated in the Mormon church, where the men need help, but it's then communicated to the women in this very patronizing way. You know, we hear over the pulpit constantly jokes about how the church would fall apart without the Relief Society. That's a bunch of crap. So, because what I'm hearing, this irrelevancy, the fear of the irrelevancy of men is really a fear that they will lose power, if I can be so blunt. And I, you know, I'm not married. I want to be married. I want to have children. I want that as part of my life. I do subscribe to that ideal. I want that ideal. But this underlying philosophy that the only reason that I'm supposed to marry somebody is so I can control their sex impulse, I really take issue to, because I have a fabulous sex drive. I'm looking forward to exploring that, and I don't really feel like I need to get married to control. Well, maybe I should, but I maybe that's my problem. But I'm hearing a lot of fear when it comes to this whole concept about men needing to be pulled through marriage. I don't want to be in a marriage where I'm feeling like I need to control my spouse. And that's a little bit of what I'm hearing. So, respond away.
Well, I'll pass this along to Brad, but just briefly on the topic of whether men are bad and women are good, I, for one, think that men are very good.
Well, you can see what Doral thinks of himself. I guess I have an image problem or something. No, I think it is. I'm overstating my case, and I'm stating it simply because I think it's unique, and I think we need to look. I don't want to be mistaken for Dan Quayle. Maybe I'm just too hung up on that. I think in some ways that Dan Quayle was wrong. Stephanie Kuntz was right. It is the way we never were, and we as Mormons. If you want to talk about polygamy, I'm kind of digressing here, but since I've already brought that up, I will. No, I won't. There, okay, we'll just leave it hanging there. Need to address your question. I overmade that case for harnessing male sexuality simply because it's something that is so often ignored. But it is, anthropologists really do ask themselves, what do we do with the men? Because, look, a man, you know, has sex with a woman, and she gets pregnant, and she goes through this incredible change. You know, who she is, what defines her physiologically, mentally, spiritually. I mean, I don't know, the whole thing. She's changing. Man's not changing. If he wants to change, he needs help. She doesn't need help to change, like he does. I'm overstating the case, okay? But I'm trying to make a point, and it's in the statistics. Who heads the vast majority of single-parent households? It's not men, okay? So, you know, I don't think that anyone should take what I just said today and make it into a textbook and how to go inspire men. No way. But I'm just trying to make the point. And we can talk about polygamy whenever you decide to get around to it.
Let me just add a comment. Because I think it's probably obvious that many of the things that Brad said I would agree with, but it comes back to this concept of ideals, whether this is a statement of ideals or not. And I think there are wonderful ideals that are in there, but I don't think the document is a statement of ideals. It doesn't claim to be a statement of ideals. It is categorical in claiming to be universal and eternal. And that is why I have difficulty in, well, these are all fine ideas. I have difficulty in getting too far along with the thought process of saying, oh, well, this is a nice ideal thing for us to strive for.
have problems even with it as an ideal because it often excludes real families. And when we think of people who find they don't fit the ideal, find the ideal being pushed to the extent that they feel marginalized or isolated or out of step in any way and choose not to affiliate themselves with us anymore, or at least to drop into inactivity, when we're losing real people who have real kids, and we lose that generation as well, then I have a problem with that gap. Did I see your hand up? Can you come up here?
Your comment about most of the heads of families being women, I don't think in many of those cases, or single parents, yes, being women, is not necessarily a statement on the position that they've chosen, but the position they've been forced into. The women are the heads of those single families because they can't walk away from their children as freely as a man can. And we see that in teen pregnancies and other kinds of things. So it's not necessarily that women are so committed as much as many of them are just stuck.
The number of Murphy Browns.
The whole idea is men need to be stuck too. That's my point. And men can't be stuck simply by their biology or their whatever, their destiny, if you will. They can go their own way, and they know it. And not just, you know, we as society are telling, Hollywood is telling them that, women are telling them that, you know. If you don't think that men want to have sex, I mean, there's, let's see, what is the, you got gentlemen clubs, there's a whole industry for gentlemen clubs, there's a whole industry for pornography. Tell me that its correlate exists for women.
Suggestions?
I actually want to switch back and go back to the ideal universal thing because, of course, the church sets up ideals, and I do think this is a statement of ideals. Just like, for example, in doctrine, we're held up, for example, to the ideal of Christ-like love. Well, I sure don't know many of us that live that or achieve it or, frankly, are even very nice to, you know, the neighbor down the street that ran over your dog or whatever. You know, so I guess I would say I see this as a statement of ideals, just like most of the rest of our religion is a statement of ideals, and part of what we're about is living up to that set of ideals. Now, I think we have a lot of problems in society and in the church society of how do you be inclusive and acceptive and accepting and deal with the variety of circumstances that life presents while still trying to achieve some ideal, even if the only one is Christ-like love. You know, that presents its own set of challenges, but I don't think you say that the ideal is no longer there just because the reality doesn't match it. Because if that were true, I don't think any of us would believe in a gospel of any kind. And I also was reacting somewhat, Doral, to your putting on a particular lens in reading the proclamation, and it clearly is an indictment of anything but the traditional marriage structure, but I'm not sure you can extend that to, for example, a condemnation of the individual. And it seems like, you know, in the second paragraph where you were saying that the gender statements are really being harsh against someone who has homosexual tendencies, I think you're reading the same assumption into that as the joke that you told. I mean, I don't know that gender the statement about gender is a statement about sexual relationship or marital relationship. It's a statement about gender.
Well, then I would ask you, what is the purpose of gender, and what is its relationship?
I think having gender differential is part, that sex is a purpose of the gender differential, but I'm not sure that's the only purpose. I mean, you look at little kids, you know, boys, little girls, men and women, there certainly are differences that are not solely related to sexual organs. And I'm not sure I completely understand those or even understand why that is, and some of it's societal and some of it's probably biological and who knows what else. But certainly there, in the way that men and women approach things, think about things, react to each other, there are elements that are part of that that are not sexual. And I think those elements are important and that we need to learn from each other because of those differences, even when they have nothing to do with sexual relationships.
Actually, I agree with you completely. And I think this is the mistake that has been made by church leaders, to equate sex or having sex with, for example, issues of homosexuality. It's behavior, you know, and if these people would just stop having sex with other men, with other women, whatever, then they wouldn't be that. It's a behaviorist approach, this is the approach that's taken by the church. That's why the church pushes thousands of people into reparative therapy and all that sort of thing. So it's, I think, the church that's precisely taking that position. And I would agree, gender, it probably has lots of other functions, and even sexual expression has lots of other functions other than procreation, at least in our human society. I would agree with that. I think it's precisely the church that has taken the other view and boxed itself into a corner, because it becomes circular, you see. Gay men are, you know, they have sex and they shouldn't, and it circles around again. If they would just stop having sex, then they wouldn't be gay. Well, if you just stop having sex, are you going to stop being straight? You know, I mean, there are so many circular arguments that just don't work, and so I agree that it has more facets than that. And I think my argument would be it's precisely the church that has taken that narrow view rather than myself.
I wanted to address this because I think that, you know, Doral is coming from a point of view that he's more instructed on the details of this than I am. But I will grant that, yes, I mean, the church has really gone after men who are gay and, you know, tried to make them so that they're not gay, and I would guess that there are some church leaders at this level, and we're talking about 15 men here. When I define the brethren, I mean the Quorum of the Twelve, or the Council of the Twelve. You know who I mean. We're supposed to learn this in Parista meeting, you know, but I don't know what's wrong with it. Must be gender confusion. I don't know. Okay. Anyway. I will grant Doral that there are probably some apostles who would like to write into this that we're doing this because we want to reform gay men, and if they'll just stop having sex, then they'll just stop being gay. I'll grant him that there are some apostles who believe that. I'll bet you dollars to donuts there's not 15 of them. And what we have here is a declaration by all 15. This is just record 15 to agree. You're not going to get them to agree to. You're not going to get them to agree to come down on gay members like that. I think you're reading much too much into it. What they're focused on is creating the next generation, not defining what, you know, what lifestyles are right, which are okay. They want to say here's the lifestyle that society needs the most. Society can survive fine, you know, with, I don't want to put it, don't be offended by this, but with or without homosexuals. It cannot survive. I'm sorry, it's true. I mean, we cannot survive. As far as contribution to society and everything, but I'm just talking about, we're going to be, who are the kids on the street who are going to be stealing your hubcaps? They're going to be kids who are produced by heterosexual union, okay? So it's really a survival of society, get down to the real essentials thing. If we can only say one thing, then let's do that. The other thing is, let me expand a little bit on the whole ideal idea. You know, I look at this like this is World War II. You know, Nazi Germany is out there. And, you know, if you even look at the language, what kind of things get proclaimed? War against Nazi Germany was proclaimed. Enslaved people were freed with a proclamation. That's how serious this stuff is, because this is the kind of struggle that society is in. And look at it like you're Franklin Roosevelt. You need millions of men on a uniform and grab a rifle and march into Europe and free Europe. You don't do it by saying, well, you can be a conscientious objector, or, well, you can stay home and work on the family farm, or, you know, you have fallen arches, you don't have to go. Now, you know, working the family farm and being a conscientious objector are valiant, noble things, and I think they contribute to society. But what we really need is soldiers to go invade Nazi Germany, and we don't have enough of them, and that's why they're focusing on that. This is a recruitment poster. It's not a Bill of Rights.
Okay, my turn. First of all, I'd like to refer you to Michael Quinn's research on consensus in the Quorum of the Twelve and how that's achieved and how it's proclaimed. And you may be a little bit surprised relative to the statement you just made. Secondly, who knows the origin of this proclamation? Do you know the origin of it? If you would come and tell us what you do know.
This was brought out as licensing that was trying to be occurring in life.
But was it issued in the same way that the 1978 revelation was issued?
No.
I am saying no. I don't think they should be viewed the same. When they have the first presidency saying, we, in words of soberness, declare that this is revelation. I don't believe those can be equated at all. So why this has been issued, by whom, and exactly what that means for us as members of the church, I think is a little bit obscure, at least from what I know about it. To be crass, could we say as a public relations statement? No, you wouldn't go that far? Okay. All right. Okay. I hope that helps someone. There were about three hands up. Come.
When I looked over the title of this particular panel, I recognized that certainly the church's statement on homosexual relationships and actually its position in wanting to quash any attempts for homosexual people to form any legal families would be a topic that we would be considering. In this group, I don't think I would need to make any validating statements that I see the utter silliness of labeling any relations of homosexual people to be a threat to marriages of men and women. That's just an absolutely preposterous argument. But I've heard it anecdotally. I've heard it anecdotally. Certainly. And you know, you've probably all had experiences when you try to explain to a, you know, try to ask someone who's advocating position in denial of, I'm starting to get circular myself, someone who doesn't like the idea of gay civil union, how does that actually threaten marriage between a man and a woman? Nobody's been able to logically explain that. Yeah, well, right. Yeah, as if we made a choice that we were going to be gay or straight. But anyhow, having said that, recognizing that that is in a component, I think there's a larger component that we haven't been addressing that I had hoped would be addressed in this group, that we do have non-traditional families who are don't happen to be a man and a woman. I will out myself as a woman who's been married many years, who's been home raising children, and I believe that something like only 10% of American families actually fall in that model, so I'm one of those 10% oddballs. That we have larger, far larger numbers of women who are doing it on their own, and how that fits into our church community. I'll use a personal example. A number of years ago, I spent the summer in another city with my children. We went to church and were attending. We were involved for a number of weeks. After, three or four weeks of attending this ward regularly, attending all meetings, my husband was in town and came to church with us, and that was the point in which people noticed me. I walked in with a man and two children, as opposed to walking in with two children. And I think we have a significant problem in the church as we want to promote families. I think you, Brad, pointed out significantly that one of the greatest threats to the families is poverty. It's poor parenting. Or was it you? Okay, I'm sorry. But pointing out that poverty and poor parenting are a tremendous threat to the family, but also our lack of support to people who don't fit the Aussie and Harriet mold and wonder if you could address that.
I think in the our particular ward, I think we're the odd ward because we're Ozzie and Harriet, and I think that's becoming more and more the way the church is, and I think it underscores that I think that is primarily what the church is concerned about. I have to admit that I've seeing it from Doral's point of view, I can see he'd have this interpretation that's different than mine. He's looking at it like this is a gay discrimination thing, and I'm looking at it like, no, this is a heterosexual male recruitment drive, because what predominates in wards is not, of course it can't, gay couples in wards, it just doesn't work. We know that. Well, okay, do we want to lose the generation of kids who grow up with gay couples and lesbian couples? I don't think we want to lose them, but again, I think the whole point of the proclamation is what is the biggest problem? And that's what it doesn't pretend to address everything, and I don't think we can expect it to. It's addressing the problem that you brought up indirectly, which is, the vast number of people are being raised in single-parent households. And when the brethren look at the doctrine and say, well, that doesn't really jibe with what we believe, or that's not the ideal that we've, if you look at the scriptures, it doesn't really jibe with the ideal, scripturally that we've always been talking about. And I think this kind of reconciles it and says, people, wake up, let's stop assuming that it's okay to pursue all kinds of different lifestyles of society. There is a lifestyle which, if pursued by the vast majority, is going to produce a better society. Now, the way why in our own community, when a single woman with kids shows up in society, does she not get noticed and she gets greeted with open arms when she shows up with her husband? I think that's in part two things, because of the structure of the ward. That ward needs a scoutmaster, and you, sister, can't be it, and nobody else wants to be it. No, you haven't. You haven't. That's impossible in an LDS ward, because it's set up so that it has to be a man. Again, it has to be a male role model. Role modeling is really big in the church. And the other thing is that I hate to say this, but the priesthood quorums are going to look on you as a need. Your plumbing goes bad, our plumbing went bad, and I solved it. I solved it without calling our home teacher. Okay? And single moms are more likely going to call their home teacher. So if you're a home teacher and you see two families cross the threshold, and one is Ozzie and Harriet and the other is Grace Under Fire, you're going to want to embrace Ozzie and Harriet. It's not the Christian thing to do, absolutely, but it's something we need to get over. But anyway, I think that's the dynamic. Sorry, that wasn't very inspiring.
No, it wasn't. How about promoting a model of supporting people who need our help the most instead of recruiting people who have the most to contribute?
Yeah. I'm just telling you, why is it that this happens, and I think that's why.
I also worry about any family with one gay sibling, with, just anybody who says, this person is being rejected by this church, it can't be my church anymore. Not if they feel that way about my brother. And if we're going to take this hard line, we're going to lose real people.
Well,
real people matter.
What do you mean if they feel that way about my brother? Are we talking about the proclamation on the family?
I think many see it in that way. If my brother isn't welcome in this church, it can't be my church anymore.
Well, how do you get that out of the proclamation? How do you get unwelcomeness out of it? Because there's lots of single moms who don't fit into this.
Is that a huge leap
no.
that I'm making here? I think it's a pretty self-evident one. And for me, there's always a gap between the ideal and then the practical application to real people, and keeping people in the church, keeping congregations vital, supporting people who need it the most, somehow winds up being more important to me than promoting some ideal.
There's nothing that says we're not supposed to support people here. There's nothing about love thy neighbor issue. It's not a love thy neighbor document.
So we need a new document?
No, all I'm saying is don't expect it to be more than what it holds itself up to be. That's all. it holds itself up to be universal and eternal. I don't know about more you can get than that, you know.
Eternal is in there. Universal is not a word that's in there.
Well, that's true.
First, I want to thank both of you for doing such a good job presenting your points of view. This is a proclamation to the world. I think that perhaps the world is most concerned about the ninth paragraph, responsible citizens and officers of government everywhere to promote these measures designed to maintain and strengthen the family as the fundamental unit of society. I guess my question is, how far should the church go in promoting that measure? And I guess I'm interested to know what you think the consequences are of doing that.
Well, I think you've heard enough of me recently.
Yeah. I will say that in general, because as we've talked about before, this document apparently was produced directly in relationship to the whole issue of gay union and all of that sort of thing. So sticking with that theme, I am personally disappointed that my church is involved in this at all, except as a loving, accepting, supportive person for my friends, for myself, for others. It's clearly, as I said, a call to arms. And my disappointment goes deeper. I mean, I think there have been enough articles about the goings-on in California to realize that even from church leaders there were attempts to get people to hide their relationship with the church so that no one would know that this was a Mormon initiative rather, and all that sort of thing. It's a kind of Machiavellian view of, you know, the ends justify the means. And I'm personally, and you know where I'm coming from, so I have to say this, I'm personally disappointed that so many people I know are not included, and that this is this political issue is created by the church, which does exclude people.
I wonder if anyone has any sense of where this will all go. Is this a position we're going to ultimately reverse? Those of us who grew up during the bad old days when we defended not ordaining members of African descent to the priesthood and then saw all that turn around. Will this change, and will we live to see it change? Does anyone have a hypothesis there? Yeah.
I think it's telling that in the very first paragraph, second sentence, it says, or first sentence, marriage between a man and a woman. The church did not have to specify a man and a woman, because everywhere else where they say man and woman, it's without an article in front of it. And I think that we're going to look back on this document and say, this is the stake through the heart of polygamy. It's dead.
Thank you. There were other hands in the back. Come on. Well, you can both come, and then you can line up.
A couple of points in the question. If you listen very carefully in sacrament meeting, you come to realize that we don't just value families, we worship them. They really are the heart of the church in a sort of abnormal kind of worship. I've heard a lot about idealism. What I see here is a model, and this is a general question. How did we arrive at the conclusion that this is the ideal model? What procedure did we? Did we just consider an origin and therefore by default it becomes ideal? Or was there some reasoning, some prayer, some other method that we used to come to the fact that it is the ideal model? I was raised picky. Point number 7, next to the last sentence, disability, death, or other circumstances may necessitate individual adaptation. That suggests to me that, in fact, there can be variance to this model. How much variance are we willing to tolerate? Would you speak to that?
Oh, well, I would tolerate a lot of variance. I think that's not a mystery, yeah? I think It is significant. This is one of the things I had too much to say at the beginning. I skipped over a lot of things. But I think it is interesting that after all of this model, we have this one little hint, you know, that maybe things could be a little different than this model. And you were suggesting, someone was suggesting that maybe 10% of the people fit this model. So there's a disconnect here, although I understand Brad's contention that this is an ideal, not a statement of reality. It certainly is not a statement of reality. If we're talking about 80 or 90% that don't fit this model, and then in one sentence they give a little hint and say, well, disability or death. I mean, what, you know, really tragic circumstances do we have to have in order, well, it does say, or other, what is it? Other circumstances that gives a little bit a broader nod. But I think there's a tiny, tiny nod to what? Maybe 80% of our population instead of being inclusive. So, I mean, I think you understand where I'm coming from there.
So, Doral, you're saying that you're not proud to stand up in testimony meeting and say how that you have a testimony in other circumstances? Sorry. Really quickly, on the origins, I think there's other things that were going on when that led up to the proclamation. There really was a national debate about not just gay marriage, but, I mean, the whole Murphy Brown thing in the late 80s, early 90s, Dan Quayle being very outspoken, that's what kind of prompted Stephanie Kuntz to release her book, which has also really blazed the trail, The Way We Never Were. And 3 years later, the very same year that the proclamation came out, Fatherless America, which is a book that really influenced me, where this is where I'm getting some of these crazy ideas about marriage is really not for women, it's for men, and recruiting them. In fact, he uses the term conscript throughout his book, and I know the brethren have read it. It's been quoted at least once in General Conference by Elder
one of them. Yes, I think you mentioned it. Then why don't you just follow?
It seems to me, and when we're talking about ideals, that the basic ideal that I think should be promoted is basically that we should love each other, and that we should be faithful and true to our relationships, and that any children that come thereby, we love and care and nourish and nurture them. That's, I think, covers everybody. I think that covers every situation, and I don't see why we need a document that picks and chooses, that limits who we can choose to love and who we have to pick to love. Loving is the primary cardinal principle. What's wrong with that? If you do that, you're recruited. You're recruited to raise the next generation just as faithfully and just as powerfully as any other ideal I can imagine.
Did you want to respond to that?
Yeah,
Should we maybe get this comment too, and then you can respond to both of them?
Well, I guess what I've been wondering all along here is if this model and ideal, I do believe that the model and ideal has been taught by the leadership of the church always, and so why does that need to be a proclamation all of a sudden in 1995? And you seem to have ideas on that, but I've never felt less convinced that that needs to be a proclamation. Why should that be proclamationalized? And I come to the conclusion there's only one reason to proclaim. No, I'm using proclamationalize intentionally. If you can proclamationalize that, you can use it like a club, like a weapon, and a lot of Mormons do.
Well, look, I mean, again, we're expecting this to be an encyclopedia of everything that the church is for, and it's not. Yeah, the church is for home teaching, too, and it's not in here. I mean, love is, of course, do we really believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ, and we believe in that we receive that through the New Testament and other things of Scripture, and we quote it all the time, and we know that the first and great commandment is love one another. And every one of these 15 guys have said that a million times over the pulpit.
That's my point.
Okay, what I'm saying is we're inferring that the brethren don't believe in love one another, and there's nothing in this document that says, well, we don't believe in one loving one another anymore. There's nothing in here that says that or implies it, and I don't know why you're saying it.
Well, the suggestion is such an
document might be redundant if we could just get back to the more fundamental principles. Can we get you to the mic this time? Okay.
Whoops. Interestingly for myself, I find myself agreeing with both of you, which probably shows you how schizophrenic I am in some respects in regards to this, although I think you both probably do agree somewhat with each other. To me, what has always been problematic with this document has been that it touches upon what I think you have said. Sorry, what was your name?
Brad.
I think in trying to create the ideal, but being so specific is to be totally exclusionary about what I think would have been valuable. If it had been more general in its nature and talked about the fact that, and I think most of us understand that sociologists and others have said that children do prosper ideally in homes where there are mentally competent and loving parents who are moms and dads. You find little girls need fathers, little boys need mothers as a part of their growing up, ideally. Reality-wise, that doesn't happen for all of us. We may have two parents of opposite sex, and then one might be, as my father was, had some psychological problems, and you have to deal with some of those issues, or you may be with a mom who has other issues. So the ideal rarely fits our reality always. But this document is so specific about what is considered the by our brethren to be the only right way to be. You know, fathers have to support their families. Mothers should stay home. Whereas if you're talking, and if you really focused on how to nurture a child, you would have made it more general. You would have said, nurturing children and bringing children into the home and raising children in a home is the most important thing, and parents should do that in the best way and focus on the end result rather than the means to get to that result, to me would have made this a stronger document and would have then created the document that I think you want this to be that I don't see it being, which is that it would have said this is a roadmap as to how to try to create, regardless of your family circumstance, the reality of nurturing and bringing that generation into fruition in healthy societies. Interestingly enough, they are so specific about things that I think we will find ourselves in a short period of time as Mormons, if we hold too strongly to this, is being out of date. Just yesterday, and I see your fear, and I think it's real in terms of biology today, but yesterday in the Washington Post, some of you may have read about the fact that we now have the ability, technology-wise, to create eggs out of normal cells, which means that potentially long-term, males will be irrelevant. And not just in the raising of children, but in the procreation of those children. We have a statement here that says, we further declare that God has commanded that sacred powers of procreation are to be employed only between man and woman lawfully wedded as husband and wife. What does that do even at this very moment about people who have sperm donors? Those people aren't married and that they're creating children. What does that do about in vitro, you know, sometimes, of course, that sometimes means that process is between married people, but it's not necessarily. There are whole issues of ramifications that this document, if you held strictly to, would preclude us from being engaged in or even talking about. And therefore, to me, I have to fall back, I think, on what Dora was saying, is that this document is really a response to a political issue and is only, I don't want to say marginally, but is only secondarily related to the fact that the brethren are that concerned about family life. And as you also mentioned, somebody mentioned, this heterosexual marriage is not challenged by heterosexual relationships cannot, any more than homosexual relationships, be challenged by those people who have differences. You either are or you aren't in your own sphere. And is there, you know, society is challenged by the differences. And there lies the issue, but not those individual families.
I'm sorry.
No, that's right.
We did just get a timeout sign. Our challenge, I think, does remain looking at ideals, deciding which ideals to subscribe to and why, and then figuring out how we as individuals and as communities of faith can support each other in whatever situations we really find ourselves in. Thank you all for contributing to this discussion, and I trust it will go on in some form as you leave this session. Thank you.